Evershine Model Paper 3, page 99, History 1, History of India, time 3 hours, maximum marks 100. Section A. Mark on the outline map provided 5 sites of trade and commercial importance and write a note on the economy of Guptas. 5 plus 5, 10 marks. So the places marked on the map are Mathura, Pataliputra, Ujjain, Lothal, Broch, Sopara and Thamralipta. Page 100. Agriculture was the main occupation of the people during the Gupta age. Land surveys were conducted periodically. Gupta rulers took interest in encouraging agriculture. No land had to be left uncultivated. Irrigational facilities were provided. Wheat, sugarcane, pulses and cotton were grown. Whenever grains were stolen, the culprits had to pay 3 times more than the actual quantity. Spices, indigo, betel nuts, betel leaves and medicinal herbs were also grown in plenty. The peasants were, however, burdened with heavy taxes. The practice of granting lands to a few persons led to the growth of a feudal economy. Sometimes the feudatories made land grants. Subletting the lands was also a common practice. The land was sublet to peasants so that both the parches would enjoy the benefits of land and labour. The land owners had the right to evict the cultivators of land according to their wishes. So permanent cultivators also lacked security. However, Guptas promoted agricultural production to a large extent. Many industries also existed. Cotton, silk, linen and woolen clothes were manufactured. The textiles were found at Gujarat, Bengal, Deccan region and Tamil Nadu. Jewels of gold, silver, ivory, etc. with delicate carvings were manufactured. Carpentry, weaving, pottery, blacksmithy and metal works were the main crafts of the age. Guilds of traders and artisans were also organized. Merchants and craft guilds were headed by elected presidents. The executive officer were empowered to remove erring officers. Whenever the guilds engaged themselves in unlawful transactions or quarrels among themselves, the king could interfere and settle the disputes. The guilds were graded as Kula, Sreni and Gana. They fixed prices of different commodities and promoted fair competition, avoiding monopolistic practices. Wages were fixed and prices of commodities of different qualities were also fixed. The guilds had their own seals to conduct business transactions. Trade and commerce flourished during the Gupta age. Page 101. Internal trade was carried on through roads or rivers. After the occupation of Gujarat, the Guptas developed trade contacts with foreign countries like China, Indonesia, Ceylon, Java and Sumatra. The main exports included precious stones, cotton, indigo, spices, ivory, drugs, silk, copper, etc. The main imports included gold, silver, silk, camphor, horses, corals, etc. The Guptas carried on trade from Kalyan, Broch and Kambe, ports on the western coast, and Kaveripatnam, Tondai and other ports on the eastern coast. The development of trade and commerce led to immense economic prosperity. Alternate question. Mark on the outline map provided the following places and write their historical importance. Bodh Gaya, Taxila, Purushapura, Muski and Kanchipuram. So these places have been marked on the map. A. Bodh Gaya is in Bihar. It was here that Gautam Buddha got enlightenment under the Sal tree. Page 102. B. Taxila is in Pakistan. It was an ancient university. C. Purushapura is in Pakistan. It is also called as Peshawar. It was the capital of Kanishka. D. Muski is in Raichur district of Karnataka. The Ashokan inscription was found here, which mentions his title Devanama, Piyasa, Priyadarshika, Raja Ashoka. E. Kanchipuram is in Tamil Nadu. It was the capital of Pallavas. Section B. Answer any three of the following. 3 multiplied by 15 equal to 45 marks. Question 1. Describe the importance of archaeological sources for the study of Indian history. Answer. History is the chronicle of past events. History is the recreation of past by selecting important events and facts. These facts are found in various forms, which are called as sources. Sources are the raw materials for the reconstruction of history. They are the traces left behind by man. History as a subject is more or less completely at the mercy of sources. Without sources, a historian is like a fish without water. Such is the importance of sources. The ancient Indian history is reconstructed based on the availability of sources. Sources of Indian history can be classified into two, literary and archaeological. So under literary we can have indigenous or foreign, and under archaeology we can have epigraphy, numismatics and monuments. Literary sources are written records. It is of two types, indigenous literary sources and foreign accounts. Indigenous literary sources are the works written by the native people. They are found in different languages like Sanskrit, Prakrit, Pali, Kannada, etc. Foreign accounts are the works written by foreign travelers, ambassadors, etc. Page 103. Archaeological sources refers to material remains. It consists of inscriptions, coins, monuments, sculptures, paintings, etc. Archaeology is derived from the Greek words archaeus, meaning ancient, and logos, or knowledge. Etymologically, it means the science of ancient things. Archaeology is the study of material remains left behind by man. For example, weapons, monuments, ornaments, inscriptions, coins, etc. The archaeological sources are supposed to be more authentic than the literary ones, because here there is less scope for the imagination of the poet or the writer. They make those things clear where literary sources do not work. Archaeological sources are divided into A. Epigraphy, B. Numismatics, C. Monuments. A. Epigraphy or inscriptions. They have made a valuable contribution in providing us with genuine knowledge of ancient India. They are the writings engraved on rocks, stones, iron pillar, caves, bronze, copper plates, walls and terracotta seals. They provide us information about the names and titles of the kings, their conquests and extent of their kingdoms. The achievements of the kings in various fields like art, architecture, literature, the chronological history of certain dynasties, matters relating to administration, religion, etc. The study of inscriptions is called epigraphy. Inscriptions are classified according to content, donative, commemorative, eulogistic or prashanti, dedicative, religious, commercial, etc. These inscriptions are found in various languages like Pali, Sanskrit, Prakrit, Kannada, Tamil, Telugu, etc. Various scripts have also been used like Kharoshti, Brahmi, Devanagari, etc. The Indus seals provide information of Indus culture. They are the best of commercial inscriptions. They were used for commercial purposes. Page 104. Some seals bearing magical formula were used as amulets. It also gives information about the religious beliefs of the Indus people. The Ashokan edicts provide information about his Dhamma, how he spread the principles of Buddhism, his ideal of kingship, the Mauryan administration. The Kalinga rock edicts tell about the administration of the newly conquered Kalinga province. His edicts have made Ashoka to live in flesh and blood even to this day. The Allahabad pillar inscription is a eulogistic prashasti. It was composed by Harisena, who extols the conquests and achievements of Samudragupta. The Aihole inscription composed by the Jaina court poet Ravikirti describes about the achievements of Pulakeshi too. Karavela's Hathigumpha inscription is also eulogistic. The iron pillar inscription at Mehrauli of Chandragupta II Vikramaditya not only describes about his achievements but also speaks about the metallurgical skill of ancient India. It has 99% iron and is not rusted. The Uttaramerur inscription of Parantaka Chola I gives an insight into the local administration during the Chola period. Many of the dedicative inscriptions deal with the installation of images and construction of temples. The Mandasaur inscription of Kumaragupta II, the Bhitari inscription of Skandagupta, and dedicative inscriptions. The donative inscriptions contain information regarding donations made by the kings for different purposes, like land grants, for the maintenance of temples, Brahmins, etc. The commemorative inscriptions recorded the victory, birth, and death of kings. The Nasik cave inscription of Gautami Balashri records in glorious terms the victory of her son Gautamiputra Shatakarni against Kshaharata ruler Nahapana. The Chandravalli inscription tells about the achievements of Mayura Varma. Page 105. The Halmidi inscription of Kakustavarma is the first Kannada inscription. The Nanaghat inscription tells about Shatavahanas. Thus, inscriptions supply valuable information about the history and culture of ancient India. They are the main sources of information available to know the history of some of the dynasties. B. Numismatics means study of coins. Coins have proved to be a great source of authentic information on ancient Indian history. They throw light on the contemporary political, religious, economic conditions and the art. Ancient Indian coins were made of gold, silver, copper or mixed metal. Coins made of gold, silver and copper themselves become the scales of economic conditions. In prosperous empires, generally gold coins were made. Copper and mixed metal coins were used only in the cases of economic crisis. Silver was used in a flourishing economic condition. The dates inscribed on the coin tells us the dates of the king. It also helps in knowing the religious life of the various kingdoms. The various figures of gods and goddesses inscribed on the coins throw light on contemporary religion. The figures of musical instruments inscribed over them tell us about the state of art in that particular period. The places where the coins are found are of special significance to the historians because they help them in estimating the empires of the various kings. Coins also tell about the aesthetic sense of the kings. For example, a coin of Samudragupta's period shows him playing the veena, which proves that he had a love for music. Coins help in bringing out new facts into limelight. There are many periods of Indian history about which our knowledge is too confined. In such difficult situations, coins do well to throw light upon history. For example, the chief source of the history of Ramagupta is the coins of his period. Page 106. Coins also help in knowing the relations of a particular empire with other foreign countries. Indian coins have been found in the foreign countries, which proves that India had connections with other countries. Many earthen utensils and terracottas are found after excavation at various places. These are also of historical importance because they throw light upon contemporary folk art, religion and social conditions. These are found in various shapes and colors. Thus, the above discussion makes it clear that they provide valuable information. C. Monuments. Old buildings, statues and ruins are quite important in Indian history. They throw light on the cultural conditions of a kingdom. The temples, stupas and other monuments not only provide information regarding contemporary religion and spiritual studies, but also give enough dues to the act of that period. The excavations carried out at Mohenjo-daro and Harappa revealed the ancient human civilization. The excavations at Takshashila proved that this city was established and ruined three times each. The excavations at Pataliputra revealed some new facts about the Mauryas. It showed that in the Mauryan period, wood was used in architecture. The temples found at Devgarh and Bhitri throw light upon the art of the Gupta period. The paintings of the Ajanta caves also prove the artistic merit of that period. Many important monuments have been found at Sanchi, Bharut, Mahabalipuram, Nashik and Karle, etc. Apart from Indian monuments, those found in other countries also throw light upon Indian history. The ruins of many monuments in foreign countries construct a new chapter in the proud cultural history of India. There are many such monuments in Southeast Asia. The Shiva temples at Java, the statues inscribed at the big temples at Borobudur and Prambanan in Central Java, and the ruins of Angkor Wat and Agkorthram prove that Indians had established their colonies there and spread their strength and culture. Chronological information can also be drawn from these monuments. Page 107. Many other minor objects like beads and pots have also provided a definite outline for the reconstruction of the ancient Indian history. From pottery, we learn about the social and economic conditions of the people of that age, while the study of beads enable us to know the extent of foreign influence. Thus, the above sources help in knowing the ancient Indian history. Question 2. Explain the main features of Indus Valley Civilization. Answer. The Indus Valley Civilization holds an important place in Indian history. The discovery of Indus Valley Civilization in 1921-22 pushed back the antiquity of Indian history. Perhaps no event in the whole of Indian history is as significant as the discovery of Indus Valley Civilization. This civilization was as much developed and ancient as the other great civilizations and was even superior to them in some fields. The two principal sites of this civilization, Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, were discovered by two Indian archaeologists. In 1921, Ray Bahadur Dayaram Sahani discovered Harappa. In 1922, Rakhaldas Banerjee discovered Mohenjo-daro. As the excavation work was initially carried out in the valley of River Indus, and also the first remains of this civilization were found there, it came to be called as Indus Valley Civilization. But the archaeological surveys and the excavation works made it clear that Indus Valley Civilization was not only confined around River Indus and its tributaries, but was spread over a large area. Its area was larger than the civilizations of Egypt, Mesopotamia and Persia. Thus, it extends from Suktagandur on the west to Alamgirpur on the east, from Delhi in the north to Daimabad in the south. A. Town planning. The chief characteristic feature of Indus Valley Civilization was town planning. Page 108. The Indus cities were the creation of careful planning. The excavations of the sites indicate urban character of this civilization. The remains of the city makes us feel as if they were built by skilled engineers and architects. Roads. There were broad roads which ran from east to west and from north to south, which cut each other at right angles. Thus, it divided the city into several blocks. The narrow streets which diverged from the roads were 1 meter or 2 meters wide. The main street were 32 feet wide. There was a 11 meter broad road in Mohenjo-daro, which must have been the royal path. All the roads of the city were connected to this road. Trees were planted on the sides of the road. Platforms were also constructed at places where possibly shops were built. Houses. The straight roads which cut each other at right angles divided the city into square or rectangular blocks. Within each block were several houses. The blocks were further divided by lanes. Each lane had a public well. Most of the houses had each a private well. The houses were small or big according to the need. Some houses were also two or three storied. One of the interesting features of the houses is open courtyard. The rooms were arranged on the three sides of the courtyard. The entrances to the houses were in narrow lanes. The reason of not opening towards the street must have been the attempt to stop the dirt to enter the house or rooms, and also for privacy and safety. There were no windows at all. The doorways were very low. Those were made where the walls ended and not between the walls. Doors and roof were made of wood. The walls were made quite thick so that the rooms might be kept cool. The walls of the houses are devoid of any decoration. Common walls were rare. Some houses were separated from the others by at least a foot of space between the walls. The upper stories in the houses were reached by staircases. These staircases were solid. It appears that usually cooking was done in the courtyard, but the side room also provided for the kitchen. The kitchens had raised platforms. Page 109. The buildings were built by burnt bricks. Burnt bricks were of various sizes. The standard size used for constructing houses was 27.9 × 12.7 × 6.3 cm. The floor was made of bricks, chalk and clay, etc. The walls were thick and built of bricks and plastered, so they withstood the ravages of time. Thus, the technique of brick making had been perfected to a high standard. Bricks were made for covering the drains. Wedge-shaped bricks were made for lining the walls. The bathrooms in the houses were built near the streets. It had a sloping paved roof so that the water could flow into the underground drains automatically. Both the cities, Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, had a citadel or acropolis each. It was probably occupied by the ruling class. Rectangular in shape, the citadel was formed of an artificial platform about 12 to 6 meters high. On the top of the citadel is a group of buildings for public purposes. There is fortification all around the citadel. Below the citadel lay the streets and houses of the people. The town in Indus Valley civilization were established at the banks of the river. Harappa and Mohenjo-daro were situated at the banks of River Ravi and Indus respectively. So dams were built on the rivers to ensure the safety of the town. Drainage system. The drainage system of the Indus Valley civilization was excellent. It was a well-planned and hygienic drainage system which was almost as good as that of the modern cities. Till the rise of ancient Rome, no other city in the world had such a developed drainage system. The drains were all covered with slabs. All pits and drains were regularly checked. Every house had a bathroom near the street side in order to dispose the water easily. The drains from the individual houses were connected to the street and main drains, and the water was carried away from the city. The main drains even had manholes for inspection and clearance. Page 110. Each house had a sink. In the floor of the kitchens, some pottery vessels were found sunk in the floor to receive waste water. These were called soak pits. Another important feature of the drainage system was pottery and stoneware pipes being used, which were fitted both vertically and horizontally. The drain channels were covered by loose bricks, which could be removed whenever it was necessary. Thus, a brick-lined channel flowed down every street and sometimes in small lanes into this tributary drain from the houses on either side of the road. The Indus Valley people had excellent supply of water. Every house contained its own brick-lined wells. Some wells have been found at some of the places of Mohenjo-Daro, but no such wells have been found at Harappa. Some of the wells built 1,000 of years ago are in perfect working condition up to the present day. It speaks about the technical perfection of the builders. Public buildings. Apart from the ordinary houses, there were public and government buildings also. One such building was the Great Bath, found at Mohenjo-Daro during excavations. Historians believe that this pool had religious significance, and on various sacred festivals people used to have a dip here. This pool has steps to reach the water. Around the pools there were rooms. There is a well near the pool to fill the water in the pool. The other huge buildings found in Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro were the granaries. These were used for loading grains and distributing it by the government officers. In Lothal, dockyard was discovered. It is an area with docks and equipment for building and repairing ships. It could accommodate several ships at a time. The pillared hall found at Mohenjo-Daro was perhaps an assembly hall or meeting hall where people used to assemble for state business. Page 111. Thus, the fine drainage system, careful planning of the town, and well-arranged water supply clearly show that every required step was taken to make the citizen comfortable. No such arrangements were available anywhere else. Even the street light system and watch and ward system at night also existed to avoid danger. The people in towns were also not allowed to throw the waste matter in the lane or along the street. They had to throw at a particular place fixed for collecting it. Thus, the systematic way in which the cities were laid out tells that it was methodically planned and not just built haphazardly. Whosoever looked after the town arrangements, whether an individual or a committee of men, must have been thoroughly competent. B. Social life. With the excavations in Mohenjo-Daro, there existed different sections of people which may be grouped into the following classes based on occupations. The first class consisted of priests, astrologers, physicians. The second consisted of warriors. The third consisted of traders, artisans, and artists. And the fourth of manual workers like peasants, fishermen, weavers, domestic servants, etc. People were both vegetarian and non-vegetarian. Barley, wheat, rice, fruits, vegetables, dates, milk, etc. were used. Non-vegetarians took beef, mutton, poultry, flesh, etc. Regarding the dress, not much evidence is available. Men wore shawl as an upper garment and dhoti as a lower garment. It appears women put on a skirt and a cloak was used as an extra protection. They used cotton and woolen clothes. Ornaments were popular among both men and women. While both used necklaces, farmlets and finger rings, women alone used girdles, nose studs, ear studs, anklets, etc. Ornaments were made of gold, silver, ivory and precious stones, but the poor used shell, bone, copper and terracotta. Women knew variety of hairstyles. They used ivory combs, bronze mirrors, face paints, lipsticks were used. Page 112. The people had love for indoor and outdoor games. Dice, bullfighting, dance, singing, chess, clay modeling, fishing, hunting and cockfighting were means of amusement. The large number of toys found at Mohenjo-Daro show that children were fond of playthings. Children's toys, such as clay models of birds, animals, wheeled carts, etc., were common. Variety of earthen vessels made of potter's wheel have been discovered. Vessels of copper, bronze, silver, porcelain were used. Weapons like axes, spears, daggers, maces, bows and arrows, shings made of copper and bronze are found. They deposed their dead by cremation. Many urns containing human bones and ashes have been found, and a large burial ground has been unearthed at Harappa. Cases of burial are rare and belong to the time of their decline. C. Economic conditions. Agriculture was the main occupation, followed by cattle rearing. They knew the art of irrigation. They grew wheat, barley, rice, cotton, vegetables, etc. They domesticated animals like cow, bulls, buffaloes, sheep, goat, camel, etc. for milk and meat purposes. A number of handicrafts like weaving, spinning, dyeing, pottery, carpentry, metal industry existed. Mohenjo-daro was a great trading center for internal and external trade. Bullock carts were used for transporting goods from one place to another. Internally, they had trade links with South, Central, and Northwestern India. The trade with foreign countries was also carried through water routes. A dockyard at Lothal shows they carried on external trade through ships. Indus seals, art motifs, and their articles have been discovered in West Asia, Egypt, and Mesopotamia. They exported gold, ivory, beads, pearls, etc., and imported precious stones like silver and other metals. Harappa, Lothal, Kalibangan, Rupar, Surkotada, Mohenjo-daro were the main centers of trade. Barter system was in vogue. Page 113. They knew the use of weights and measures. They had knowledge of decimal system. A shell scale at Mohenjo-daro and a bronze scale at Harappa have been discovered. D. Religious life. 1. Male worship. Seals have been found with a man seated in yogic posture on a stool and surrounded by animals. He is called as prototype of Shiva. 2. Female worship. Figures of mother goddess have been found which refers to female worship. 3. Animal worship. Seals have been found with figures of humped bull Shiva and tiger, that is Parvati. 4. Tree worship. Seals have been found with tulsi plant, neem tree, and peepal tree, thereby showing nature worship. And 5. Amulets have been found in many sites, which also tell about superstitious beliefs of the people. E. Seals. Seals form the main source for the study of this civilization. They are made of terracotta, ivory, stone, or sphalerite. More than 3,000 seals have been found. Most of them are square or rectangle in shape and small in size. On most of them, there are finely engraved figures of various animals like bull, unicorn, antelope, elephant, human, and pictographic writing. Each picture gives a different meaning. F. Script. Indus people used pictographic writing. It has not been deciphered to the acceptance of all, but it seems that the direction of writing was from right to left. In some cases, it was right to left in the first line and left to right in the second line. Page 114. G. Art. The seal, figurines, amulets, pottery, bronze idol of a dancing girl, statue of a bearded man, figures of Pushpapati, attractive designs on pottery, jewelry, terracotta toys are examples of their artistic skills. Question 3. Narrate the life and teachings of Mahavira. Vardhaman Mahavira, 599 to 527 BC. He was the last of the 24 Tirthankaras. The Jains believe their religion was the outcome of the teachings of the 24 Tirthankaras. His original name was Vardhamana. He was born in Kundagrama, a suburb of Vaishali, in North Bihar. He was the younger son of Siddhartha, chief of the Kshatriya clan called Nantrika clan. His mother was Trishula, the princess of Lichhavi clan of Vaishali and sister of Chetaka. Vardhamana had a religious bent of mind. He saw evils of the society and wanted to reform the society. But he did not want to hurt his parents. Therefore, he led the life of a householder. He married Yashoda, and a daughter was born to him named Anujya or Priyadarshana. The parents of Mahavira and other members of his family were the followers of Parshvanatha. Vardhamana Mahavira too was influenced by the Jaina doctrines preached by Parshvanatha. At the age of 30, after the death of his parents, he left his home with the permission of his elder brother and became an ascetic. For 12 years he wandered from place to place, led a life of complete self-mortification and continued his penance. He wandered naked and homeless. People mocked at him, set dogs on him. They beat him with sticks and with their feet, threw stones and disturbed him in his meditations. They thought he was mad, but Vardhamana Mahavira withstood it all. He never sought medical aid for his wounds. In winter, he meditated in the shade. In the heat of the summer, he seated himself in the scorching sun. Page 115. After all these hardships, he ultimately attained supreme knowledge or enlightenment or Kaivala Jnana at the age of 43 under a sal tree on the Rijupalika outside Jrimbhika Grama. From then, he became the Kevalin, the omniscient, Jina, the conqueror or victor, and Mahavira, the great hero. He conquered both peace and misery. For the next 30 years, he spent his life preaching his doctrines throughout the country. He toured many places like Magadha, Anga, Mithila and Koshala. Among the hundreds of followers, he was able to attract 11 who were considered important. These 11 disciples were known as Gunadharas. At the age of 72, he passed away at Pava or Pavapuri near Patna. Teachings. Our information about his teachings is derived from the holy books of Jains. The original holy books are known as Parvas or Parvas, which are 14 in number. But these 14 Purvas were rearranged into 12 Angas in the Jaina Council at Pataliputra. A. Vardhamana Mahavira did not believe in the existence of God. He did not believe that God created and controlled the whole universe. According to him, God is the highest, noblest and fullest manifestation of all the powers which is latent in the soul of man. Man is the maker of his own destiny. His emancipation does not depend upon any God or savior. He said that a man can get rid of his miseries and sorrows by his own efforts. He can even rise to the position of a God by following the path of purity, sacrifice and virtue. B. Vardhamana Mahavira laid great stress on ahimsa or non-violence. The center principle of Vardhamana Mahavira was ahimsa paramo dharma. He said that not only men and animals but also plants, wind and fire has souls. Pain or injury was felt by stones and plants like men and animals. One should avoid injury to all in words, deeds, thoughts, etc. A true Jain should strictly follow ahimsa regularly in daily life. That is, page 116. 1. No Jaina should take honey. 2. Every Jaina should cover his mouth before speaking. 3. Every Jaina should screen the lamps to protect insects from flame. 4. Every Jaina should sweep floor before walking. 5. Every Jaina should avoid the profession of agriculture, since it involves destruction of plants and harm to many living things in the soil. C. Jainism condemned the sacrificial rituals and rejected the theory of Vedas. According to Mahavira, it was a waste of time to recite mantras and perform sacrifices. D. Mahavira did not believe in the caste system. Everyone were welcome to join his faith. He rejected the supremacy of Brahmins. He believed in establishing an order which would lead the people to the path of truth. E. Mahavira believed in the theory of the soul. He said that every element is a combination of material and spiritual factors. Material factor is perishable, but the spiritual factor never perishes. Soul is eternal. It goes through the cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. Even after death, soul lives on and takes birth because of karma. The deeds of a human being during his lifetime will determine the birth and rebirth of the soul. As the soul passes through the various stages of life, it experiences both beautiful and ugly aspects of life. With the realization of the eternal truth, the soul tries to discard the desires which have been the source of its misery. The ultimate realization of the soul is the liberation of the soul from the karma cycle. F. Vardhamana Mahavira also believed in the theory of karma. Karma is the accumulated effect of the actions done in the past lives. Because of karma, the soul is in a state of bondage. Karma is the cause of birth, death, sorrow, and suffering. By severe austerities, self-torture, discipline, and formation of fresh karma can be prevented. What has been accumulated already can also be reduced. Once the karma is destroyed, the soul would come forth in all its glory. The soul shines fully and becomes Paramatma or pure soul. Page 117. G. Vardhamana Mahavira believed in the principle of Nirvana or salvation. He held that Nirvana can be achieved by destroying karma. This can be done by severe discipline and self-mortification. For this purpose, he said to observe the three ratnas or the three jewels of conduct. That is, right faith means belief in the jinas, right conduct means dispassionate attitude towards sense, and right knowledge means knowledge of the eventual liberation. The combination of these three would lead to Nirvana. H. Vardhamana Mahavira accepted the principles of the 23rd Tirthankara Parshvanatha. Parshvanatha taught the people the four great virtues. Satya, speak truth always and not tell lies. Ahimsa, non-violence or non-injury. Aparigraha, non-possession. Asteya, non-stealing. To these, Vardhamana Mahavira added the fifth virtue, that is Brahmacharya or celibacy. These were the teachings of Vardhamana Mahavira. After his death, his disciples spread his principles to the different parts of India. Very soon, it became an all-India religion. Several royal families encouraged Jainism. Some of them were Bimbisara of Magadha, Ajatashatru of Vaishali, Nanda rulers, Kharavela of Kalinga, Chandragupta Maurya. In the south, Gangas, Kadambas, Chalukyas, Rashtrakutas, and Hoysalas patronized it. Question 4. Explain the contributions of the Kushanas. The Kushanas were the most powerful of all the foreign invaders that came to India. Page 118. They established their rule in the northwest part of India after destroying the Sakha Empire. They also made significant contribution to the art and religion of this country. Kadafises I, Kadafises II and Kanishka were the greatest rulers of this dynasty. Administration. With the help of the coins and inscriptions, we come to know about the administrative system of the Kushans. Their vast empire included many foreign countries also. For convenience, they divided the empire into several administrative units such as Rashtras, Ahasas, Janapadas, Deshas or Vishayas, Gramas, etc. The administrative efficiency can be proved from the fact that there was no revolt or agitation in any part of the empire. Economic prosperity. During the Kushana period, India established trade relations with Western countries. Means of transport and communication were increased. Trade and commerce flowed between India, China, Persia, Mesopotamia, and especially Rome. Cotton, woolen and silk cloth, diamonds, ornaments, ivory made articles and other countries and India received gold in the form of foreign exchange. The seaborne trade of India was carried on through Persian Gulf and Red Sea. Literature. Kushan rulers were great patrons of learning and literature. Many Sanskrit scholars were patronized by them. They made Sanskrit their state language. Inscriptions were also written in Sanskrit language. Prominent scholars of the Sanskrit language were Ashwaghosha Nagarjuna, Vasumitra and Charaka. Ashwaghosha was the greatest scholar of the time of Kanishka. He was well versed in philosophy, music, literature, religion and debate. Owing to his versatile abilities, he was appointed as the vice president of the fourth Buddhist council held in Kashmir by Kanishka. He wrote Buddhacharita, Saundarananda, Sariputra Prakarana and Vajrasuchi. Nagarjuna, a great scholar and philosopher, was an exponent of Mahayanism. He wrote Prajna Paramita Sutra Shastra and Mahavibhasha Shastra. Page 119. He is called as Indian Einstein for having explained the theory of relativity. Charaka was a reputed royal physician in the court of Kanishka. He wrote Charaka Samhita, a unique work on Ayurvedic science. Religion. Rulers followed the policy of religious toleration. Kanishka patronized Mahayana Buddhism. This form of Buddhism took birth during Kanishka's period. He made untiring efforts to make Buddhism popular, which had been losing its popularity. As a result of his efforts, Buddhism spread in China, Tibet, Japan, and Central Asia. He also convened the Fourth Buddhist Council in Kashmir to bridge the differences pertaining to religion. Art. Rulers of Kushan dynasty were not only great conquerors but also patrons of art. Kanishka took keen interest in architecture. He laid foundations to the towns of Purushapura and Kanishkapura. In his capital Purushapura, he constructed a beautiful tower of wood, a Buddhist vihara and stupas. Gandhara School of Art. The growth and origin of the Gandhara School of Art was the most significant feature of the Kushana period. Gandhara was situated on the northwest frontier of India. Mahayanism was responsible for the growth of this art. Gandhara was the meeting ground of Indian, Chinese, Iranian and Greco-Roman cultures. So Gandhara art was influenced by all the foreign cultures. Gandhara style actually originated in Bactria and Parthia under the Greek rulers. In this art, the statues and images of Lord Buddha were constructed according to the Greek technique, but the idea, personalities and spirit were Indian. That is why Gandhara art is also known as Indo-Greek art. R.C. Majumdar has rightly remarked, "The Gandhara artist had the hands of a Greek and the heart of an Indian." Full-size statues of Buddha and images of the Kushan rulers were produced by employing this new style of art. Images were made of black stone. Page 120. It is clear from the above description that there was a great contribution of the Kushanas to the life and culture of India. India came in close contact with other countries. Trade and commerce developed to a great extent. Sanskrit received patronage and moreover, a revolutionary change was introduced in the field of religion and art. Question 5. Write a note on Chandragupta II. Chandragupta II, 380-412-13 AD. Chandragupta II was the son of Samudragupta and Datta Devi. He was also a great and powerful ruler of the Guptas. He inherited the military genius of his father. Chandragupta II also expanded the Gupta Empire by waging a number of wars. Gujarat and Malwa occupied a strategic position on the west coast of India, and the control of imports and exports was monopolized by the western satraps, whose last king was Shaka Rudrasimha II. The Guptas lost heavily as far as proceeds from the trade were concerned. Chandragupta II gave his daughter Prabhavati to the Vakataka ruler Rudrasena and managed to get the support of his army. With a huge army, Chandragupta II descended with full force on Rudrasimha II. Rudrasimha was killed and the prosperous port of Gujarat like Bharuch, Kambe, Sopara and Ujjain fell into the hand of Guptas. The effect of this war was immense on the trade and commerce as well as the culture of North India. Once again, the road from Pataliputra and the manufacturing cities of North and Central India were opened up to the sea. Goods were brought to these ports and the Western traders poured Roman gold into India for cotton, silk, spices, perfumes, sandalwood, etc. The effect of this wealth can be noticed in the variety and number of coins of Chandragupta II. The iron pillar inscription at Mehrauli says that a king named Chandra defeated a confederacy of chiefs in Vanga and, crossing the seven mouths of the river Sindhu, conquered Vahalikas. Vanga denotes eastern Bengal and Vahalika, the regions of Bactria beyond Hindu Kush mountains. Some scholars located Vahalikas in Punjab. King Chandra of this inscription is usually associated with Chandragupta II. Vanga was directly placed under Gupta rule, but due to lack of sources, it should be accepted with a little amount of doubt. Page 121. Almost all important Gupta rulers adopted the policy of matrimonial alliances. Chandragupta II also continued this. He married Kubera Naga of the Naga family. The Nagas were a powerful ruling class, and this marriage helped Chandragupta II in expanding his empire. He also gave his daughter in marriage to the Vakataka king Rudrasena, which helped Chandragupta II to establish his political influence in the Deccan and against Sakas. The Talagunda inscription of the Kadambas gives information that the daughter of Kakustavarma, the Kadamba ruler, was married in Gupta dynasty. This proves the traditional policy of Guptas of forming matrimonial alliances with powerful royal families. Chandragupta II issued different types of coins in silver and copper. His gold coins testify to the pomp, power and personality of the king. Some of the types of coins were archer type, horseman type, couch type, lion slayer type and chhatra type. Chandragupta II assumed a number of titles. From his inscriptions we come to know that he had adopted the titles of Devaraj, Devagupta, Devasri, Singhavikram, Singhachandra, Param Bhagavanatha, Ajita Vikrama, Vikramanka and Aparajita. As he had achieved Digvijaya, he adopted the title of Vikramaditya. Chandragupta II was a follower of Vishnu. Like his father, he was also known as Param Bhagavata. Though Chandragupta II worshipped Vishnu, he tolerated all religions. He respected other religions and gave full freedom to the followers of all religions. Chandragupta II was not only a great conqueror and diplomat, but also an efficient administrator. He introduced a perfect administrative system throughout his empire. It was owing to his good administrative system that the country made remarkable progress in social, cultural, religious and economic fields. Chandragupta II always cared for the welfare of the people. Fa Yan, the Chinese traveller, visited India during his period. His accounts shows that Chandragupta II's period was an age of peace and prosperity. He mentions about his religious tolerance, how he made untiring efforts to make his subjects happy and prosperous. Page 122. Chandragupta II was also a patron of art and literature. He himself was a highly learned person. Sanskrit language progressed considerably during his reign. His court was studied with many great scholars. It is said that his court was adorned with Navaratnas or nine gems. It is also possible that of the nine gems, Kalidasa may have lived at his court, though not all of them may have appeared simultaneously. He also encouraged painting, architecture, sculpture and music. His reign is recognized as the golden age of the Gupta rule, owing to the development of various activities. Thus, he proved to be a great son of a great father. He was the second great ruler of the Gupta dynasty. His father, Samudragupta, established a vast empire, which was consolidated and extended by Chandragupta too. Thus, he completed the incomplete work of his father. He occupies a unique position among the prominent and successful rulers of India, owing to his achievements and extraordinary personality. During his 40 years' rule, progress was made in administration, religion, art, literature, etc. Section C. Answer any three of the following. 3 into 10 equal to 30 marks. Question 1. What were the factors responsible for the rise of non-Vedic religions? Answer. The 6th century BC was a period of religious unrest in India. It is known as an age of protest against the old order of things. During this century, a revolt was organized against the social patterns, the ritualistic form of religion, the absolute power of the priest. A new philosophy made its appearance, which was anti-social in form and anti-caste in spirit. It stood for man and woman to achieve his or her salvation as human beings. Page 123. This spirit manifested in the form of two religious movements, Jainism and Buddhism. Causes for the rise of the heterodox religions. 1. Degradation of Vedic religion. The Vedic religion was quite simple to begin with, but over the years, numerous rituals, ceremonies, and sacrifices complicated it. Hinduism lost its former glory, and many kinds of abuses and superstitions had crept into it. The common man could not perform such rituals and ceremonies, as it was costly and hence could not afford. So people were dissatisfied with this complex religion. They were looking forward for a simple religion. 2. Domination of priestly class. The life of an individual was covered with many rites and rituals from birth to death. People needed the services of priests. The common people had to depend upon these Brahmins, who regarded themselves as sole exponents of Hinduism. They became so powerful that they began to play an effective role in the administration. They themselves coronated the king. Their presence was very important in the functioning of the court and day-to-day administration. In fact, the priestly class itself began to be worshipped. This attitude developed disliking among the common people. 3. Difficult language. All the major works of Hindus were in Sanskrit. It was known to Brahmins and the learned class. Common man could not understand it, so they had to take the help of Brahmins for understanding those religious works. This was fully exploited by the Brahmins. They interpreted the religious texts in a manner which suited them. 4. Sacrifices. Hinduism, which began as a simple religion, became complex over the years with the performance of various sacrifices. People were greatly dissatisfied with the large number of sacrifices. Page 124. Some sacrifices were small and some were big, but the Brahmins benefited themselves on both the occasions. They had to be given dakshina liberally for the performance of these sacrifices. A householder also had to perform many sacrifices to get sons, performing of many samskaras, etc. Even the king or state had to suffer financially. A lot of money of the state was spent on the coronation ceremony and the performance of horse sacrifices. Thousands of Brahmins were feasted and were given dakshina. Though it was a financial loss for the state, the priests asserted their superiority and also earned money. A large number of animals were killed on those occasions. The people found no justification for the numerous animal and human sacrifices and revolted against these sacrifices. 5. Rigidity of the caste system. The Hindu society had come to be divided into four watertight compartments called castes. The Brahmins occupied a dominant position. They started demanding certain privileges like receiving gifts, exemption from taxes and punishments, etc. The Kshatriyas, who also belonged to the higher caste, could not tolerate this domination. The low classes, that is the Shudras, were condemned to a life of degradation and humiliation. They hated the superiority of Brahmins. This created a lot of discontentment among the people. They were waiting for a savior, which they found in Buddha and Mahavira. 6. Political cause. The Kshatriyas were the ruling class. They did not like the interference of Brahmins in the political affairs. There seemed to have been a power struggle between the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas. They challenged the dominant authority of the Brahmins. The founders of Jainism and Buddhism were both Kshatriya princes. They strongly criticized the rules and rituals promoted by the Brahmins. Page 125. 7. Upanishads. They greatly contributed to the rise of new religions by creating favorable atmosphere for their emergence. The various Vedic rules were challenged by the Upanishads. They emphasized the importance of knowledge for attainment of salvation. 8. Various theories to attain moksha. The advocacy of several theories to attain moksha also was a cause for the rise of new religions. The priestly class insisted on the observance of karma marga, while others insisted on the tapas marga. Some advocated jnana marga, that is true knowledge for attaining moksha. The advocacy of so many theories greatly confused the people, and they were not able to decide which one of them could lead them to the path of moksha. So they were looking for leaders who could show them the right path. 9. R. S. Sharma's view. R. S. Sharma is of the view that the rise of new religious movement led to the introduction of a new agricultural economy in the northeastern India. He argues that with the discovery of iron, the thick forests of northeast were cleared and large habitations of people emerged in the middle Gangetic basin around 600 BC. People started using large iron ploughs, shares, which necessitated the use of large number of bullocks. But the Vedic rites at that time insisted on sacrifice of many animals. This posed a serious threat for the progress of agriculture. Realizing that if the agricultural economy had to survive, they had to put an end to the indiscriminate killing of various animals in sacrifices. This is one of the primary reasons for emphasizing the concept of non-violence or ahimsa. 10. Burden of rituals. The religious rites and rituals became very elaborate, which put a very heavy economic burden on the people. As these rituals and ceremonies became costly, common man could not afford it. Page 126. Not only that, even the priests also exploited as much money as they could afford from the people. All this was not liked by the people. 11. Rise of towns. A large number of towns were founded in the 6th century BC. The artisan and traders settled in these big towns who came in search of work and business. The important towns were Kapilavastu, Vaishali, Rajagriha, etc. When the town developed, coins were used in the transactions. Slowly, the position of the Vaishyas improved. They wanted to reduce the supremacy of the Brahmins. Thus, Jainism and Buddhism, which took birth in the 6th century BC, started as movements for the reformation of Brahminism or Hinduism. The two religious movements of the 6th century BC were the outcome of the spirit of scientific inquiry and intellectual discussions which prevailed at that time. Question 2. Describe the contribution of Mauryas in the field of art and architecture. There was considerable progress of art and architecture under the Mauryas. Excellent buildings were constructed which have earned the admiration of foreign visitors and art critics. The palace of Chandragupta Maurya, the pillar and rock edicts of Ashoka, and the cave paintings of Ashoka testify the high standards which art and architecture had attained during the Mauryan age. The pre-Mauryan buildings were constructed with bricks and wood, whereas the Mauryans used stone. A. City building and palaces. The capital of Mauryas was Pataliputra. The city was very well planned. Megasthenes, who visited the court of Chandragupta Maurya, has written about the city of Pataliputra. He says it was built in the shape of a parallelogram. There was a wooden wall around the city, having some holes for using the arrows. There was a trench around the city. Page 127. In the heart of the city was a palace. The remains of this palace indicates its glory. It had many stone pillars, of which 40 have been found. The floor and the ceilings were made of wood. Security arrangements were made to this palace. The Shayanagruha was made in such a way that it was out of reach of fires and snakes. This palace was situated near the modern Kumrahara village near Patna. Fahian, the Chinese traveller, looking at the work of the palace, refused to accept that it was constructed by human hands. Ashoka founded many cities. He founded Lalitapattam in Nepal and Srinagar in Kashmir. B. Caves. A new style of architecture was developed during the Mauryan period, which was originated by Ashoka. It excavated a number of caves for the residence of monks. His grandson Dashratha also excavated some caves. Near Gaya, in the hills of Barabara, there are four caves. The earliest is the Sudama cave, which also has an edict which mentions that the cave was presented by Ashoka to a Buddhist monk. Another such cave is Karna Chaupal. In the Nagarjuni hills, Ashoka's grandson Dashratha built three caves which contain his edicts as well. The biggest among these is Gopa Guha. The other two are like small rooms. C. Stupas. It was built in the shape of an inverted bowl with bricks and stones. They were chiefly built to preserve the remains of the Buddha. A chhatra of stone or wood was put over the stupa. A path was made around the stupa for pradakshina. It is told by Divyavadana and Mahavamsa that Ashoka had built 84,000 stupas. Although most of them have been ruined now, the Chinese travellers who have seen them have recorded in their writings. Yuan Sang describes many stupas which he saw. According to him, there was a stupa in Takshila with a height of 800 feet. Page 128. Stupas were also there in places like Kashmir, Kapilavastu, Thaneshwar, Kannauj, Prayag, Mathura, Vishaka, Kausambi, Kushinagar, Varanasi, Pataliputra, Bodh Gaya, etc. The stupas of Sanchi and Barhut were originally built by Ashoka, though later extended during the Shunga period. These stupas were mainly made of red stone and comprised of three parts. The Sanchi stupa is of 17.5 feet height, and the base of the stupa is 121.5 feet in diameter. There are two pradakshina pathas around the stupa. One is on the ground level, while the other is some 11 feet higher. The stupa and the pathas are surrounded by a vedika. In four places in this vedika, there are beautiful gates for entry. D. Pillars. The best example of the Mauryan art are the pillars which were made for the propagation of the Dhamma. These are 20 in number at various places, including Sarnath, Prayag and Kosambi in UP, Lumbini and Niglivi in the Tarai of Nepal, Sanchi and Lauria, Nandangad, etc. These pillars are monolithic and are made of sandstone of Chunar. Each pillar is 40 to 50 feet high. To cut the stones at Chunar, to give them shape and to take them to various parts of the country was definitely a great example of art. It speaks of the technical skill and talent of the engineers of that age. These pillars have been brightly polished. These are so sparkling that many scholars thought that they were made of metals. Each pillar generally has three parts: the shaft, the capital, and abacus and animals. Some part of the pillars has been buried in the ground on which peacocks are inscribed. The part on the ground is round-shaped with a lessening diameter with height. The average height of the pillar is 40 feet. There is a capital on the upper portion of the pillars on the line of the bell of Achaemenian pillars. Page 129. But Indian scholars believe to be an inverted lotus whose petals are very intricately carved. Above the capital there is the abacus, which is either circular or rectangular. It acts as a base for holding the animal statues above. On the pillars of Lauriya Nandangad and Sarnath, the statues of lions are there. On the pillars of Prayag and Rampurva are the statues of oxen. The best among the monolithic pillar of Ashoka is that of Sarnath. Four lions are seen on its abacus with their backs against each other. The lion figures bear chakras, which are indicative of the religious cycle. This pillar is an expression of the supreme art of the Mauryan period. The lion figures are so intricately carved that they seem lifelike. Thus, the pillars are the best examples of Mauryan art. They are not only great pieces of art, but also represent the highest perfection of the sculptors. The animal statues are carved to perfection, which make us aware of a great artistic monument. The figures of lion, deer, and horses at Sarnath are a blend of beauty and power. These statues also represent the various facts of Ashoka, who, despite his power, always advocated and propagated the truth. Question 3. Discuss the various factors for making the Gupta age the golden age in the Indian history. The Gupta period is called as the golden age in Indian history. The multifaceted advancement of this period is responsible for a great fame of the Gupta age. This period saw great advancements in political, social, religious, economic, and artistic fields. The Gupta period is not only called the Golden Age, it is also compared to many world-famous eras. Some historians have compared it to the Periclean Age and Elizabeth Age in UK. The Gupta Age is called as the Classical Age. The following factors or causes or salient features were responsible for making the Gupta age great. Page 130. 1. Able and efficient rulers. The Gupta dynasty, which was founded in 275 AD and ended in 550 AD. During this period, a great number of Gupta rulers came to the scene and did their best to render strength and unity to India. These kings, though had more powers, never misused it. They never became dictators and autocrats. Fahian tells us that the Gupta king was a just ruler who worked for the prosperity of the people. They gave the indication of their far-sightedness and great policies. Chandragupta I was the first independent Gupta king who strengthened the empire by entering into matrimonial relations with the Lichhavis. Samudragupta, through his expeditions, took the Gupta reign to its peak. He also showed his intelligence and farsightedness by capturing northern kingdoms and by making southern kingdoms to pay tributes. Chandragupta II not only demolished Shakas from India, but also rendered political integrity to India. Kumaragupta and Skandagupta not only saved India by defeating Shakas, but also aroused patriotic feelings in the people. These Gupta rulers also did commendable work in the field of culture. They greatly encouraged art and education. 2. End of foreign rule. The Gupta rulers were imperialistic and were determined to render political strength to India. During the early years of Guptas, some branches of Kushanas and Shakas were ruling certain parts of India. The Shakas were quite strong. For the security of India, it was necessary that all these were demolished. So the Gupta rulers not only attacked these foreign rulers, but also defeated and destroyed them. This enabled Guptas to establish an absolutely Indian empire. 3. Political unity. The Mauryans, who had first given political unity to India, was lost due to the weak successors of Ashoka. This led to the establishment of foreign rule and independent rulers in India. Page 131. For some 5 centuries, India remained politically weak and disunited. The rise of Guptas not only established a strong empire throughout India, but also gave political unity to India. Thus, the Gupta kings not only made India capable of facing foreign attacks, but also made it a strong political whole. This ensured the future for the Indian culture and civilization. 4. Efficient administration. Gupta rulers not only gave political unity, but also established peace in India by their planned and efficient administration. This type of skilled administration opened the gates of economic prosperity to India. The peace thus established helped in the development of trade and culture. The Junagadh inscription speaks about the efficiency of Gupta administration. It says that there was not one person who was unhappy, poor, or tortured by the administration. Even Kalidasa and Fahiyan also wrote about the efficient and well-organized administration. The strength gained by the administration became the cause of the extraordinary advancement of art and culture. People became prosperous due to this administration. This ensured peace and hence better conditions for carrying out trade in the kingdom. 5. Financial prosperity. The Gupta rulers greatly encouraged agriculture as majority of people mainly dependent on it. They gave irrigational facilities to encourage agriculture. The stability and efficient administration encouraged India to establish trade links with many foreign countries. As a result, there was a flow of gold to India from these countries. Thus, the encouragement given by the Gupta rulers to the agriculture and trade resulted in the economic prosperity of Indians. 6. Literary developments. The Gupta age was an age of literary development. The Gupta rulers were not only known for their military power, but they also encouraged scholars. This encouragement took the literature to great heights. Page 132. Sanskrit language was greatly encouraged by them. They made Sanskrit as the national language. Various scholars and poets lived in the Gupta courts. The style of their compose was precise and beautiful, and the main literary giants were Vishakhadatta, Harisena, Vishnu Sharma, Bhasa, Bhairavi, Shudraka, Dandin, and Amara. They composed literary works of high merit to give greatness to the literature of that period. Sanskrit literature reached its zenith and under Kalidasa. His plays, epics, and lyrics are the finest literary pieces of that period. He is the finest maker of Indian poetic style. He is called as the Indian Shakespeare. Philosophers like Dinganaga also lived in this period. Many Puranas were written and many Smritis were given new shape in this age. It was the encouragement of the Gupta kings which helped the literature scale highest summits. 7. Revival of Hinduism. After the adoption of Buddhism by Ashoka and before the Guptas, Hinduism had gradually lost its influence. The Gupta rulers were the followers of Vaishnava religion. For this reason, Hinduism was revived. They declared Sanskrit as the natural language in place of Pali. They also performed Ashwamedha yagnas and Vedic rites, which strengthened Hindu religion. Many temples were built, which saw a rise in people's faith. Hinduism thus became chief religion during the Gupta reign by putting Buddhism and Jainism behind. Though the Gupta rulers were the followers of Vaishnavism, still they followed the policy of religious tolerance. They gave freedom to the followers of all other religions. The government posts were filled by people of any religion. Amrakardeva of Chandragupta II was a minister who was a Buddhist. Page 133. 8. Development of science. Science also saw great development in the Gupta period. Aryabhatta, who lived in this period, was first to prove that the earth spins on its own axis and the eclipse takes place when moon comes between the sun and the earth. Decimal system was also given by him. The greatest Gupta astrologer, Varaha Mihira, composed many works on astrology. Medicine also developed. Many works on veterinary science were written. Metallurgy was developed in this age. The Mehrauli pillar and the bronze statue of Buddha are examples of it. 9. Development of art. Art saw a multifaceted development. Architecture, sculpture, paintings and terracottas touched a creative high watermark that had not been reached earlier. The Gupta art was purely an Indian art. It exhibited a controlled show of naturalism, realism, beauty, reason and spiritualism. The main achievement in the architectural field of this period was the building of temples, and especially of those with Shikara. Some important temples were the Shiva temple at Bhumara, Vishnu temple at Tigava, Parvati temple and Nachana Kuthara, and the Dasha Vathara temple of Devgad. Sculpture also developed under Guptas. The statues belonging to Buddhism, Vaishnavism, Shaiva and Jaina religions are nice examples of spiritualism and intellectualism. Painting also achieved perfection. Gupta paintings can be seen in Bagh caves. 10. Morality. The Gupta rulers paid attention towards the moral development of the people, which resulted in the growth of religious and moral instincts in the minds of the people. People were well-behaved, well-mannered, trustful, honest, generous, and good to guests. They were tolerant towards other religions. 11. Establishment of Greater India. India established links with many foreign countries during this age. Page 134. For trade and religious propagation, many Indians reached Bali, Java, Sumatra, Malaya and Cambodia. These Indians established their colonies there and thus formed the Greater India. Thus, great development took place in all fields during the Gupta period. The Gupta rulers rendered political unity, security and peace to India. It was an age of peace, prosperity, cultural development, religious revival, intellectual efforts, great literature and arts. For all these reasons, the Gupta age is called as the Golden Age of Indian history. Question 4. Explain the achievements of Rajaraja I. 985 to 1014 AD. The most powerful ruler of the Chola kingdom was Rajaraja. He was called the Great. He was the son of Parantaka II. He was the greatest among the empire builders of the south. He was a practical ruler. He laid the foundation of the Chola Empire by extensive conquests. His accession to the throne opened a new chapter in the Chola history. Under him, the Chola kingdom developed into an extensive and wealthy empire. His first great victory was achieved early in his reign when he destroyed the Chera navy at Trivandrum. He next occupied Madurai and defeated Amarabhujanga Pandya. He also led an expedition against Ceylon. He conquered Kudamalai Nadu or Kurg. He defeated Gangas and conquered Gangavadi, Tadigavadi and Nolambavadi. He also attacked the western Chalukya ruler of Kalyani, Satya Shreya. He interfered in the affairs of the eastern Chalukyas of Vengi. He put an end to their dynastic quarrels and gave his daughter Kundavavai in marriage to Vimaladitya, the younger brother of Sachavarman I. This marriage proved the way for the union of the Cholas and the Chalukyas. He also helped the Vengi ruler Shakti Viman to secure the throne. Page 135. He also conquered Kalinga. His last conquest was that of the Lakshadweeps and the Maldives. Rajaraja was not only a great conqueror and empire builder, but also an eminent administrator. He divided his empire into 8 provinces, with Kurram and Kottam as immediate subdivisions. He encouraged local self-government and village assemblies throughout his empire. He possessed a powerful navy, which added a powerful wing to his empire. He was also a great patron of art and learning. He was a Shaiva devotee and assumed the title of Shiva Padashekhara. He constructed the Brihadeshwara or Rajarajeshwara temple at Tanjore. Though a Shaivite, he adopted a policy of religious tolerance. He cooperated with the Sumatra emperor Shailendra in the construction of Buddhist monastery at Nagapattinam, which shows his tolerance towards all religions. Tamil and Sanskrit literature were enriched during his rule. One of the characters of Rajarajeshwara Natakam has been associated with Rajaraja, which was enacted when the temple at Tanjore was completed. He had many titles like Mummadi Chola, Gangai Konda Chola, Shivapada Shekhara, and Jayagonda. Rajaraja was the greatest ruler of this dynasty. He re-established the power and prestige of Cholas. He made himself the master of almost the whole of Deccan. He has been given the title of the Great among all Cholas. He was thus the greatest king of South India. Question 5. Examine the importance of the Sangam age. The age of the Sangam is the age to which Sangam literature belonged. This age has been called as the golden age of Tamil culture. Sangam is a Sanskrit word which means association. It was a literary academy of scholars and poets who flourished for a time under the patronage of Pandya kings. It was a college or body or group of Tamil poets. Page 136. According to Tamil tradition, there were 3 Sangams. The first Sangam was created when Agastya came from North India and settled down in Madurai. Saint Agastya was its president. It lasted for 4,440 years under the patronage of 89 Pandya kings. It was attended by gods and other legendary sages. This Sangam approved the works of 4,499 scholars, whose works like Akattivam Paripadal, Madanu Narai, Kalarai Virai are important. The second Sangam was established as Kapatapuram or Alovai by Agastya when the city of Madurai was submerged. It lasted for 3,700 years and was patronized by 59 Pandya kings. There were nearly 3,700 poets in this Sangam. The greatest work of this period was Tolkappiyam, the Tamil grammar written by Tolkappiyar. He was one of the disciples of Saint Agastya. The third Sangam was founded in present Madurai. It existed for 4,850 years and patronized by 49 Pandya kings. Tiruvalluvar wrote Tirukural or Kural belonging to this period. The other important works are Silapadikaram, Mani Mekalai, Padiru Pattu, Paripadal, Pattu Pattu, Ettu Togai. These works have a lot of historical information about the Tamil people and their culture. Silapadikaram, the earliest of the epics, was written by Ilango Adigal. It is a tragic story of a merchant Kovalan who fell in love with a dancer Madhavi and neglected his wife Kannagi. She revenges the death of her husband at the hands of the Pandya king and became a goddess. The Kannagi Pattini cult began, which is the worship of Kannagi as the ideal wife. Mani Mekhalai was written by Sattanar of Madurai. It is a story of Mani Mekhalai, the daughter of Kovalan and Madhvi of the earlier epic. The author describes about how Mani Mekhalai preserved and protected her chastity from Prince Udayakumaran and became a Buddhist nun to preach its doctrines. Ettu Togai consists of 8 anthologies. It is a collection of love poems. It consists of 2,282 poems written by more than 200 authors. page 137. Pattu Pattu or Ten Idols are long poems. The poems contains verse lines varying from 100 to 782. The longest poem is Madurai Kanji, written by Mangudi Marudam. All these works of the Sangam period are classified into two groups, Agam and Puram. Agam or love deals with the internal or inner inspiration which has been realized. Puram deals with the external, that is, the virtues of heroism, generosity, etc. On the basis of this Sangam literature itself, the early history of the Tamil kingdoms of Pandyas, Cholas and Cheras can be constructed. The Chola kingdom was bounded by river Pennar in the north and bordered Pandya territory in the south. Its capital was Uraiyur. Karikala was the greatest Chola ruler who established his rule over the whole of the Tamil country. He defeated a confederacy of about 11 kings in the Battle of Venni. He invaded Ceylon. He is described as a hero in many legends. He built the famous port of Kaveri Pattanam on the banks of Kaveri. The rise of Pallavas led to the decline of Chola power. They remained under their control till about 9th century AD when Vijayalaya re-established the Chola power. The Chera kingdom was on the Malabar coast. The capital was Vanji. Nedunjeral was the most important ruler. He conquered Kadambu and crushed his enemies in a naval fight. He conquered 7 kings and assumed the title of Adhiraja. The Cheras were in the close contact with Cholas, whether as a peaceful neighbour or as a warring country. The Pandya kingdom occupied extreme south. Its capital was Madurai. Nedunjelian was the important ruler. He defeated the confederacy of the kings of Cheras, Cholas and 5 other kings in the Thayalangana battle. He himself was a poet and a patron of scholars. Thus, to know the early history of Tamils, we have to depend on the Sangam literature. They provide a lot of information about Tamil culture. Page 138. Section D. Answer any 3 of the following. 3 multiplied by 5 is equal to 15 marks. 1. Write a note on Sabha and Samiti. The two bodies, Sabha and Samiti, could impose restrictions upon the king. Rig Veda mentions these two as the daughters of Prajapati. There is difference in opinion regarding the differences between the two bodies and their works. According to Ludwig, Sabha was like the upper house, represented by priests and rich people. The members of the Sabha were very rich. They were men of great wealth and of noble birth. Therefore, it was probably a council of elders or nobles. The meetings of the Sabha took place in an assembly hall. Both political and non-political matters were discussed. Dr. Altaker, A.S., is of the opinion that Sabha was a village or clan assembly meeting for social and political purposes. Samiti was another important organ of the period. It was a national assembly of the people. During its sessions, the people were expected to be present. The representatives of entire population of the tribe or kingdom, that is, Brahmins, rich people, heads of aristocratic family, and representatives of common people. The presence of the king was essential in the Samiti. Its functions included the election of the king, deposing the king, protection of the kingdom, creation of harmonious condition. It was a powerful organ of Vedic polity. The Sabha and Samiti were two important bodies of the Vedic administrative system. The power of the king was limited and controlled by it. Starting from these were the two bodies to impose restrictions upon the king, still existed, but the growth of the kingdoms made these bodies less effective. Not only that, it must have made their frequent meetings difficult. Consequently, their control or check over the ruler must have progressively decreased. But this does not mean that the kings had become dictators. Occasionally, these bodies specified the confines on kings. Page 139. Question 2. Sects of Buddhism. During the rule of Kanishka in the 1st century AD, changes took place in Buddhism. A new Buddhist sect called Mahayana Buddhism came into existence. Mahayanists introduced a belief in the bodhisattvas, or those persons who were striving to obtain nirvana. Buddha was deified. Images of Buddha were carved and elaborate rituals were formulated. Hinayanists did not believe in idol worship. Hinayanists preached self-culture and good conduct to obtain salvation. The Mahayanists used Sanskrit language, whereas Hinayanists continued to use Pali language. Mahayana Buddhists became extremely popular throughout South Asia and parts of Central Asia. Question 3. Pushyamitra Sangha, 185 BC to 149 BC. He was the founder of the Sangha dynasty. The history of Sanghas was nothing but personal history of Pushyamitra. He tried to consolidate the remaining territories of the Magadha Empire, what he had succeeded. The highlights of his achievements were the conquests over Vidarbha and repulsions of the Greeks twice. In the Malvikagnimitra of Kalidasa, the successor over Vidarbha is credited to his son Agnimitra. In the Gargi Samhita, it is stated that Pushyamitra crushed the advance of the Greeks who reached as far as Pataliputra, and the second war with Greeks is indicated in Malvikagnimitra. This repulsion was effected by Vasumitra, the grandson of Pushyamitra. Pushyamitra occupied the throne in his old age and hence was assisted by his son and grandson. The first invasion of Greeks came under the leadership of Demetrios, the second under the leadership of Menander. The Ayodhya inscription says the triumph over Vidarbha and the Greeks was pronounced by performances of two horse sacrifices. Page 140. He also assumed the title of Chakranastin in commemoration of these sacrifices. The performance of these sacrifices indicates a period of continuous peace, prosperity, and success. The empire of Pushyamitra included Pataliputra, Vidisha, and Ayodhya. He was a renowned and a valiant king. He was a staunch Hindu and an ardent believer of Brahmanism. Buddhist tradition depicts he was a persecutor of Buddhism. He burnt monasteries and chopped the heads of monks. The above view cannot be accepted. The story of general persecution is the invention of certain Buddhist monks who could not receive royal patronage. This view cannot be accepted on the ground that some of the stupas of Sanchi and Bharut were not only spared but continued to receive both private and royal support. Question 4. Nalanda University. Nalanda is the name of an ancient village identified with modern Bhargaon, 65 kilometers southwest of Patna in Bihar. Nalanda University was one of the biggest centers of higher education. It was a major center of Buddhist learning in ancient India. Ashoka built a small Chaitya and Vihara in memory of a famous Buddhist monk, Sariputra, who was said to have been born there. As the time passed by, this Vihara enlarged itself into the Nalanda University. It was founded by Kumaragupta, the Gupta ruler, in about 5th century AD. It began to develop in importance with the rise of Mahayana Buddhism. Hence, it is called the Oxford University of the Mahayana Buddhism. During the time of Harshavardhana, it had become a university of international renown. The entire university was enclosed within a lofty wall. The buildings in this complex had a number of stories. There were 13 monasteries and 8 colleges built by different patrons inside the complex. These monasteries were given by kings as donations or gifts. It is said that Harsha built a monastery entirely of brass and a sangram, besides making provisions for feeding 40 monks daily. There was an extensive library maintained in 3 big buildings called Ratna Sagara, that is Sea of Gems, Ratna Dadhi, Ocean of Gems, and Ratna Ranjaka, Collection of Gems. It had a big collection of rare books on religion, arts, crafts, sciences, etc. Page 141. This university offered free education for its students. Apart from hostel facilities, students were also provided with free food, medicine and clothing. There were more than 10,000 and 1,500 teachers. Students came from Korea, Japan, Mongolia, Tibet, China, Ceylon and various parts of India. It was very difficult to get admission to this university. The entrance exam was conducted by the Dwar Pandita was such that out of an average of 11 students, only 2 by 3 made it. The examination went on for 5 days and only qualified undergraduates could pass it. It was a postgraduate center for higher studies. It was also a research institute. The lecture sessions were usually conducted in the form of debates and discussions. The highest degree of honor was the Fellowship of Nalanda. They were to receive a stipend for their study and research. Yuan Sang, the Chinese pilgrim, stayed here and studied for nearly 5 years. He gives us a description of the university. The university taught an extensive range of subjects which were both Buddhist and Brahmanical, sacred and secular, philosophical and practical sciences and arts. The chief subjects included the Buddhist works of different schools, Vedas, Shabda Vidya, Chikitsa Vidya, works of magic, Yoga Shastra, Sankhya, etc., philosophy, Nyaya, astronomy, Hetu Vidya or logic. The working hours of the university was 8 hours a day. Many lectures were delivered and many subjects were taught. The students found the day too short for all the discussions and debates. Juniors and seniors helped each other to perfection. Some of the famous teachers here were Nagarjuna, Aryadeva, Anga, Shilabhadra, Vasubandhu, Dharmapala, Jinamitra, etc. The university had strict rules and regulations. Students guilty of offence were expelled. A special trial room was assigned for trial and offence. The university was maintained by the revenues from 200 villages. Page 142. These villages were specially earmarked by kings for this purpose. Rice, milk, butter and vegetables came to the university from these villages. The rooms for monks were either single or double, which had a large stone platform as the bed. A small niche in the corner was provided to keep books and other one for the lamp. The monasteries had a large common kitchen and students gathered in the community hall. The official seal of the university had the title Sri Nalanda Mahavira Arya Bhikshu Sanghasya or the Venerable Community of Monks in the Great Vihara of Sri Nalanda. The emblem was the Dharma Chakra with two deers flanking it. A perfectly seated Buddha, a huge statue of Avalokeshvara, and a colossal black stone statue of Bodhisattva were found here during excavations. This university continued to flourish for 5 centuries, even after the visit of Itsing. But it finally fell to the sword of Bakhtiar Khaliji, who put an end to 800 glorious years of the highest academic tradition Asia had ever seen. Question 5. Nayanmar. The Bhakti movement, which has in its genesis the worship of God like Shiva and Vishnu, has its beginning in the south. The Shaiva saints were known as Nayanmars. Their devotional songs were known for simplicity, piety and intense attachment to God. The 12 Shaiva canonical works, Tirumalai, recognized 63 Nayanmars. The most important were A. Tirumular. It is said he was a Siddha from Kailasa and migrated to South India. He said, love and Shivam are not different categories of existence. Love eliminates into Shivam and rests in that condition. His work Tirumandiram is a manual of Shaiva mysticism in 3000 hymns. It constitutes the 10th book of the Shaiva canon. B. Karaikal Ammai. She sang the praises of deity of Tiruvalangadai. Her works were the earliest to enter the Shaiva canon. Page 143. C. Ayyadigal Kadavarkon. He was a ruler who abdicated in favor of his son and devoted to religious life. His Kshetra Tiruvenha contains list of 21 Shaiva shrines, including that of Mahakal of Ujjain in Malwa. D. Appar or Tiru Navukarasu was a contemporary of Mahendravarman I. Mahendravarman was converted to Shaivism by Appar. He spent his entire life serving Lord Shiva, visiting many shrines and singing songs. The intensity of his devotion is characterized in his hymns, 307 in number, which constitute books 4 to 6 of the Shaiva canon. E. Nana Sambandar was the greatest Nayanmar. He composed 384 hymns, which constitute the first three sections of the Shaiva canon. The Pandya ruler and his subjects were influenced by him towards Shaivism. He considered Shiva as his friend. F. Sundaramurti. The legends speak of the miracles he performed and the services in cause of divine. He was a contemporary of Chera ruler, Cheraman Perumal. Sundar's devotion to Shiva was that of an intimate friend. He was given the title of Tambiram Tola, friend of God. He composed thousands of songs, but only 100 hymns have survived and make the seventh book of Shaiva canon. G. Manikkavachakar or Manikkavasagal was the minister of Pandya king, probably Varaguna II. Realization came to him and he dedicated himself to the divine life. His hymns from the Tiruvachakam or the Tiruvasangam and another work, Tiruchiram Balakovai. Tiruvasagam forms the eighth book of Shaiva canon. It is a spiritual autobiography of Manikkavachakar. His hymns record his vivid religious experiences and trace the progress of soul from the bondage of passion and ignorance to the liberty of light and love. Of the 63 Shaiva saints, the above saints were the prominent. The 63 Shaiva saints were drawn from all classes and castes. This only indicates that God's love are independent from all these material conditions of life. With that, we come to the end of Evershine Model Paper 3.